Welcome to session one of High Probability Selling. There's a section of the course which, for anybody that's listened to this recording as a recording, you won't have heard because where people introduce themselves personally. But what we're going to be doing is, my name is Neil Myers and I'm going to be the trainer. And the course is essentially divided into two parts. We have the high probability prospecting is going to form part of the first six sessions, and after that we have high probability selling. Of course it's all high probability selling, but in the prospecting session we're going to talk a lot about prospecting, and we're also going to talk about the existence of things called people called high probability prospects and the essence of the system. Now as you can judge from the fact that we give six sessions, fully half the course of prospecting is an important thing, not just because it's one of the biggest problems that most salespeople face, usually because they don't have a high enough number of high quality prospects, but also because there are a tremendous amount of number of ideas and associations, both intellectual and physical, about prospecting. So the objective of this part of the course, of the prospecting course, we've laid out on the first page of the workbook, which should be a coloured page, and it should say high probability prospecting purpose. Is there anybody that does not see that page? Good. Now the purpose there's a threefold purpose. The first is to shift your objective from getting the appointment to determining whether the prospect qualifies for an appointment. The second is to eliminate call reluctance, fear of rejection and sales resistance. And we're not going to be doing that by any form of mental trickery or by any form of positive self-images, but by completely changing the paradigms or offering you an opportunity to completely change the paradigm of selling and prospecting. And the last section is we're going to teach you how to identify your target markets so that primarily you only make appointments with prospects who need, want and can afford what you're selling and are willing to buy from you if you can meet their conditions of satisfaction. By the way, that says requirements, I think, there, but it should say conditions of satisfaction. That's who we determine are people who we call high probability prospects. And we're going to spend a lot of time talking about them, but before we do, what I'd like you to do is turn to the next page of your course, and you should see a multicolored pyramid divided into different layers, which looks a bit like something that you would see on a colorblind test. Is there anybody that does not see that? And it's titled Typical Market Stratification. Good. What you see is a diagrammatic representation of any marketplace. And we're talking about the marketplace in terms of people. And interspersed within each of those dots of different colours, you'll see a series of red dots. And those dots represent people that we will term for the purposes of this course as high probability prospects. Now, high probability prospects can occur at any point of the selling of this typical market stratification pyramid. But typically, just to remind ourselves of what a high probability prospect is, it's somebody who wants what you're selling, probably needs what you're selling, can afford what you're selling, and is still willing to buy it from you now if you can meet their conditions of satisfaction. And in each of those sections, you'll see some high probability prospects. Some of them will be people, some prospects as a whole, or can be described as people who don't need or don't want what you have. Some people who need it, don't want it, can't afford it. Some people who need, want, can't afford it. We're moving up the pyramid. Many people who need don't want it, a few that need don't want and may want it later, some that need want and may buy it later, and a smaller number who need, want and will buy it now. Now, if you had a choice as to any part of that pyramid that you could spend your time talking to solely, where would it be?
Top, of course.
Okay. Now, let me ask you a question. Now, has everybody here sold, is either selling something or has sold something, is that correct?
Yes.
Yes.
Good. Now, typically, for the prospects that you currently talk to, or if you've only been in your sales position a short time, people who you talk to in other selling positions, where typically would they be in this diagram, in terms of this diagram?
The blue dots.
Where would that be? How would you describe it in terms of the stratification?
A knee one made by a letter.
Okay. Does anybody else have anything else to say?
I'm not exactly sure that I understood what
the question was.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Typically, when you talk to your... By the way, just give your name before saying anything so we know who you are.
Matthew.
That was Matthew. So, Matthew, typically when you talk to people who are prospects before they bought anything, how would you describe them? Would they be in terms of this diagram?
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, need, want, and may buy later.
Okay. Is that typical?
I think so.
Okay. Anybody else have anything else to say?
This is Bill Rafferty. I'd say a lot of mine are in the need, don't want.
Need, don't want.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, and that's not untypical either. And Robert, or was it Robert before?
Yeah, I didn't understand your question as well. It's Robert out of Michigan. I thought you were speaking about where most prospects are. But,
well, I'm talking about where most people are that you currently speak to right now, who are prospects for you.
Usually, I would say it's between they need, they don't want it, but they may want it later. I would
right.
say that. Yeah.
And okay, good. So the question is, if we know that we want people at the top, why do we speak to people anywhere else?
This is Matthew. Because
yeah.
I'm not exactly sure how to find those people.
Okay, good.
Hello, it's Chris. Because we're strongly encouraged by our management to pursue the people, oddly enough, in the orange and yellow sections.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
And why else?
Kind of manipulate our way to the top.
Okay. And why else?
This is Robert Jones. I would just agree to that. At my company, we subscribe to planting seeds to people who don't want it, but they may want it later. So you just
right.
finagle them while you can to.
So what would we say under our current paradigm? All these answers are absolutely correct in terms of our current paradigm. So does anybody else have anything to add, by the way? Or so, in terms of what we've just said, what do we think is the basic function in terms of that paradigm of the salesperson? Why do we exist as salespeople?
This is Matthew.
Mm-hmm.
To get people to change their minds and buy from us.
Okay. And anything else? What and else is anybody else?
To create the wants or needs.
Anything else? Okay, so essentially what we're saying is our role as salespeople is that our role as salespeople is to persuade somebody by some shape or form to buy from us. And is that currently
right,
the case?
I would agree with that. Yep. This is Robert, I would agree with that.
And this is also what our management encourages us to do. In fact, part of our role and part of our value as salespeople is often seen as our capacity to change people who may have a need or but who don't necessarily want what we have to buy from us now, and that's really how our merit as salespeople is measured, correct?
Right.
As persuaders. So let me ask a couple of further questions. The next is when we're what would we do? What would we be willing to do to persuade somebody to buy something from us right now, given our current state of knowledge? What sort of things have we done? What sort of things do we do?
It's Robert Jones. In my business, we do anything from taking a guy out to dinner, football game, basketball game, anything really.
And what else in terms of when you talk to somebody, what sort of thing are you going to be doing typically?
This is Matthew.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in past sales experiences, for example, inbound call center, I mean, I was good there just because I would think faster. I mean, I knew everything that they would say,
mm-hmm.
and I kind of knew how to twist the truth to make it whatever they wanted.
Okay.
You know, I heard certain tones of voice come in, and I'd be like, okay, I know exactly where I'm going to go with this person.
Okay. Now, when you were doing that,
how did lying.
Okay. So you were willing to lie?
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you for saying that, because very few people are prepared to admit that on the phone. But that's pretty common in sales. Anybody else have anything to add to that? What other forms of behavior in terms of persuasion? Somebody said that they're willing to take people out, to kind of wine them and dine them. Matthew has been candid enough to admit that he would be willing to shake the truth and even lie if he had to get somebody to do to make a sale. What else?
This is Robert again. I think there's a lot of insincerity, like, you know, pretending you like stuff that the client likes and you really don't. I mean,
so you would be willing to act insincerely?
Yes.
Fawn or flatter?
Right.
Right. Does everybody agree with that?
Yes.
So let me ask everybody a question. If this is not the common experience of conventional sales, please say so now. So let me ask, when you're engaging in that type of behavior, how do you feel about yourselves?
Chris, depressing. Depressed.
Very depressing. And what else?
This is Matthew.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, there was many times, especially like I was talking about in the call center I worked for, where I felt pretty good in a weird sort of way. I mean, just because I was winning, and you know, I'm the number one guy there, and you know, these dumb hicks are no match for me.
So you felt kind of superior at first, and then afterwards you felt guilt?
When I quit was when my little brother came to visit, and I had been I'd been promoted to be a sales trainer there, and I got on the phones and I took a couple calls and make sales to show him how it was done, so to speak. And I got off and he looked at me and he goes, you know, for the first time ever, I'm really not that proud to be your brother.
Mm.
And everything sort of changed after that.
Mm. Anybody else have anything to say?
This is Bill. I think it discourages you. It's hard to maintain your enthusiasm and move forward when you're compromising yourself or you don't feel good about what you're doing.
Okay. So again, these are all fairly common things. And the last question that I have just at this point is, then why do we do that stuff? Why? Why do we behave in those ways?
This is Robert out of Michigan. That's what you're taught. That's how you make money. I mean, you gotta just, you know, just keep doing it until you make money, or when you, that's the way it is.
Fine, and one shape or form, the basic belief is that if it comes to selling, that's kind of variations of that are the only game in town.
Right.
Is that a fair comment, guys?
Yep,
I agree.
Yeah. Right. So that is the that is the essence, that is the fundamental of what we would call, in high probability selling, the accepted traditional or conventional paradigm. Now, what we're going to show is we're going to show in this course that is certainly not the only paradigm in sales, and that's not necessary, and in fact it's actually counterproductive to actually being a very effective salesperson. But we're not going to argue that by means of emotion, and we're going to argue it by means of reason, and you're going to discover it by means of your own behavior and reason in actual practice. So let's look at this in terms of typical market stratification again. What you will see there is that at any point in that marketplace there exists something called these characters called high probability prospects, whose definition I've previously given. So the question becomes, first of all, we're asserting that first of all, let's first of all see if that's true or not, and if it is true, how high probability prospects come to exist. So we're going to talk about how high probability prospects come into being, and then we're going to talk a little bit about a paradigm shift and how that applies to high probability selling. So let's talk about how high probability prospects even come to exist. Because here's the thing. What we're saying to you is that the role of the high probability prospector is not to persuade anybody at all. The role is to identify who is and who is not a high probability prospect, and to only make appointments or meetings with people that are high probability prospects. Of course, if you don't know how high probability prospects come to exist, or even believe that they exist, or believe that they exist in sufficient numbers, then you won't A, recognize them when they appear, and B, you won't know what to do with them when they do, or you'll believe that there are so few of them that you can't make a living out of them anyway. If you ask most salespeople, what would you do with somebody who's ready, willing, and able to buy your product or service from you if you can meet all your conditions of satisfaction, he would say to them, well, you just sell them, of course. Unfortunately, most believe that there are so few people like that that you can't really make a living out of it. So let's examine all of those ideas and see what conclusions, if any, that we come to. So the first thing I'd like you to do is just flick over the page to Paradigm Shifts and see a page called Information Overload. Is there anybody that does not see that page? Now, I have to tell you, the first thing there is this information is information that has been gathered from Bacon's database. And what you're looking at is a series of categories which show us that the number of print and broadcast images that we are subjected to, at least in North America, on a daily basis. Now, North America is higher than in other parts of the Western world, and quite significantly higher, but you're still talking in the tens of thousands in other parts of the world, so the essence of our argument is not really changed. Now, the only thing I should tell you about this that you're looking at now, does it say 40,000 print and broadcast outlets?
Yes.
Okay. That's at least 2 years out of date, unfortunately, because we're still getting Bacon's latest information because they only do this every couple of years. But I'm given to understand that it's at least 50% higher than that right now. And the only categories in which it has significantly changed has been newspapers, dailies, and weeklies, which have both gone down. But you'll see there newspapers, weeklies and dailies, 1,600, weeklies, 8,700, magazines, 3,500 to consumer, 3,000 business, newsletters, 4,500, radio stations, 10,000, TV and cable stations, 1,200. Every category apart from newspapers has risen significantly since we first gathered this information, which, as I say, is more than 2 years old. In fact, I think this information is closer to 4 years old. Now, does anybody notice a striking absentee from that list?
The internet?
Yep. Who said that?
Robert Jones out of Michigan.
Yeah, absolutely right. So if you add to it, and I'm sure that I'm going to hazard a guess that one or two of you have computers, and I'm also going to hazard a guess that one or two of you spend a portion of every day in front of them looking at the internet. So if you add that to the internet images, you will see that we have an enormous amount of information that we are confronted with on a daily basis. And of course, this information doesn't include personal contacts that we have with friends, relatives, work colleagues, neighbors, and all manner of others. So unlike societies in previous ages, we have more information which we are being confronted with and which is bombarding us on a daily, weekly, monthly, hourly basis than just about any other society ever in history. But unfortunately, selling, as it's conventionally taught, doesn't seem to reflect that fundamental change. There seems to be a fundamental belief in most selling systems or the traditional sales paradigm or conventional sales paradigm that selling is really pretty much the same as now as it was 20 years ago and 30 years ago and more. In fact, most sales methodologies which we're taught, which normally consists of some variation of this, and this is that we find somebody by any means who has a remote need, as we perceive it, for our product or service. We then attempt to describe that product or service, or we attempt to elicit how deep their need is by exploring either their pain or their desire, via probing questions. We then describe our product or service in the most flattering terms possible with features and benefits. We then attempt to close them, and if they don't respond to that, we attempt to close them again, and we keep doing it until we sell them or they get rid of us, or we give up. Now, that sales methodology and paradigm has been around formally for at least 100 years, and probably informally for a good deal longer than that. Now, that sales paradigm existed in a world where information and the dissemination of information was entirely different from the world that we experience today. For example, when some of these sales methodologies were first formulated in the 30s and so, the television was something that hardly had any effect on the buying public, let alone things like cable TV or anything more sophisticated than that, or computers. Now it has an enormous effect. So here we're confronted with an enormous amount of information. Now, does anybody disagree with our primary, our premise there, that's the current situation? Good. So what do you think is the effect of this enormous amount of information that we're confronted with on a daily basis? What effect does it have upon us as a whole? What are some of the effects?
This is Robert Jones. I think that people automatically tune out. They tune out to sales messages. I mean, they just don't have time for them.
Yes, and I think that's an extremely accurate description of the process. They tune out to sales messages. In fact, they tune out to most messages. Does anybody disagree with that? Why do you think that we do that, by the way? Why do we tune out to most of these messages?
This is Matthew.
Yeah.
Because I think, as a whole, we are better informed, and in some cases, the consumers are better informed than the salespeople on the products they're selling, and most of the sales messages are not anything interesting. They're mostly full of
But I would mostly agree with what you said there. Most of the sales messages, and in fact most of the messages, are not things that interest us. They're not things that we want. They're not things that we perceive as needs. And so for the sake of sanity, we tune most of it out. Can you imagine if we could absorb even 5% of all these enormous number of messages? We'd drive ourselves bonkers, wouldn't we? So,
this is Bill Rapley. Can I add one thing there?
Please.
I noticed that the information saturation, there are a large segment of my market that believes that the objective knowledge is out there for their taking, and they don't need the salesperson. They don't trust the salesperson, and they can go on the internet
and get all the information that they want.
And they can be a do-it-yourselfer.
Yeah, now that's also a very good point. So you see, and we're going to come back to all of those things that you said, either maybe not in this session, but subsequently. And that's very true. By the way, something you mentioned there is that they don't trust the salespeople. Is that correct?
Yes.
And there's a very high level of distrust in salespeople generally. Why do we think that is?
Matthew, I mean, because most salespeople don't give people a reason to trust them.
That's right, absolutely. Because what most salespeople do is attempt, as we all have admitted that we're prepared to do under the old paradigm, to do more or less anything to get the sale within the law. And that type of person does not engender trust. So, conventionally, salespeople are not trusted, sales methods are not trusted, but also we have a marketplace out there that is overloaded with information, but in many instances is also very well informed about specific products and services. So, how does one begin to process from the point of view of sales? Well, let's have a look at another piece of information which comes to us from the world of psychology. Psychologists and I think social psychologists is the term, and inform us that there are things out there called primary information filters. And these are methodologies that we have that filter out information that we determine to be useful, or filter out information that we determine to be unuseful, and allow us to filter in information that we determine to be useful. And generally speaking, this goes into four categories, three of which are of no interest to us as salespeople, and one of them is. So let's talk about them. The first category is things that we would call necessities and emergencies. So things like food, clothing, shelter, warmth, that type of thing. The next is something that we would term as abiding interests. And by the way, these are in terms of their importance as well. Did somebody just join us?
Yes, Neil. This is Dennis Aguilar speaking.
Hello, Dennis. I'm afraid you've come in a little bit late, but we'll just listen on and see what happens.
Thank you.
We're talking about primary information filters. So the first is necessities and emergencies. The second order is abiding interests. And these can be all sorts of things, love, sex, music. I have an abiding interest I scuba dive, so I have an abiding interest in things under the sea. I also really like animals as well, so things to do with animals I tend to have an abiding interest in. And you can also...
This is Robert. I had to interrupt you. Could you repeat the first?
Yes, the first is necessities. You might want to write this down, folks. The first is necessities and emergencies. Things like food, clothing, shelter, warmth. The next is abiding interests. And this can be all sorts of things. Love, sex, music, fashion, occupational interests. The next category is perceived needs. Okay? And perceived needs can be all manner of things. And they can be things like that you perceive that you need new clothing, you perceive that you need a girlfriend, you perceive that you want to get rid of your girlfriend, you perceive that you need to go to the pictures, go to the cinema this evening, or whatever. And the last is committed wants, which are exactly the same as those perceived needs, except for one thing. People that have committed wants will buy now, if you can meet those wants. Okay? So, let's just take, let's just give some examples to make some of those clear. Let's say we all have an abiding interest in a particular form of music, and we're enjoying that particular form of music together in a concert. And somebody rushes into the concert hall and shouts out, "Fire!" And we believe them. Now what would we do?
Run for the exit.
Yeah, we tend to leave as quickly as humanly possible, correct? And that's exactly the reason why it's a criminal offence, I believe, to rush into a crowded public area and scream fire. And the reason for that is because our necessities and emergencies are of greater priority to us than our abiding interests. And perceived, and now that necessity and emergency immediately clicks into that. So these are what we filter out. Now we're also told that at any one time we have a relatively small number of committed wants. But when they are committed, we're ready to act upon them. And as salespeople, we are looking to connect with people who have a committed want to our product or service, and only those people. And everybody else, we really don't want to be talking to. So, coming back to our paradigm, before we come back to our market stratification, I want to talk a little bit about a paradigm, and then we're going to see how the paradigm shift meets in terms of our market stratification. So let's talk about paradigms for a little bit. What's a paradigm? A paradigm is the complete body of accepted knowledge about a particular topic or subject area. Or another way of looking at it is the world as we know it. So on the page between those two diagrams, you should have something called paradigm shifts. Let's have a few examples of a paradigm shift. Fish. If you're a fish, unless you're a flying fish, and only then very briefly, or occasionally a lungfish, your paradigm is water. In fact, you don't even think about water because it's all around you and it exists all the time. Everything you know consists of water, and nothing but water. Now, every so often, a piece of technology will enter into your world, and that technology will be in the form of a fishing net, or an animal's paw, or mouth or a fishing line, and it will pull you out of your paradigm. And when that happens to fish, that is a tremendous shock to their system, because the fish then realizes that there is a completely different world that doesn't exist. That's for a fish. For a human being, up until relatively recently, most of the Western world, at least, believed that the world was flat. In fact, some people still do believe the world is flat, so I'm told. They remind me a little bit of people following some of the traditional sales paradigms. But those people believe that the world is flat. Now, if you believe that the world is flat, and you truly believe the world is flat, you'll have certain other things that you believe. Like, for example, if you sail far enough west, north, east, or south, you're going to fall off the edge. And that's therefore not a very good thing to do. And now, if you... I don't know whether somebody with a greater historical knowledge than me may be able to tell me. I don't know if it was Copernicus or before that, but at the time when we determined that the world was round, everything changed. Navigation changed. The notion that you could travel far, far east and finish up coming right back round on yourself completely changed. And everything modified. So that was a worldview. Up until the invention, I believe, of the microscope, it was a fairly common belief that congregations of vapors or their imbalance was what caused disease. With the invention of the microscope, we were able to see things called germs, little microbes, and the presence of these were found to be evident in people that were experiencing the symptoms of certain illness, and therefore we came to realize that it wasn't vapors that caused illness, but germs which caused illness. The technology of the microscope entirely changed the paradigm. Transportation, up until the invention of the internal combustion engine, transportation was largely biological, either in the form of animals or in the forms of the elements, like winds, or in the forms of us rowing or pushing or pulling various means of transportation. With the invention of the internal combustion engine, a new piece of technology, our whole notion of travel and the capabilities of travel changed, so that for now it's not uncommon for us to traverse the globe in hours rather than years or months, or even to go leave the planet entirely. So all of these things are examples of paradigm shifts. Does anybody have any questions about paradigm shifts? Good. So let's go back and have a look at our typical market stratification again. What do we know? We know that there are out there in the world an enormous number of pieces of information. And some of these pieces of information relate to our specific product or service. And we also know that out there in the world, at any one period of time, there are some people that are probably going to want to buy our product or service. Now, there's an easy way to know this, and here it is. Is there anybody on this line whose product or service, is not, if it's not being sold by them, is not being sold by their competitors? Anybody? Good. So somebody out there, somewhere, somehow, at some time, wants what you've got to sell, correct?
Right.
Right. So out there are people called high probability prospects. They exist. Now, the question is, how do they come to exist and how can we identify them? It comes back to what we said before. Now, typically, for all of us, if we can all think of a major purchase that we've made in the not-too-distant future, not-too-distant past, can some of us think of some of the steps that we went? Did anybody, for example, has anybody in the last 2 years bought a car?
Yes.
Okay, good. Who was that?
Matthew.
Okay, Matthew. So when you were first thinking about buying a car, what sort of thing did you do? How did you proceed?
I went on the Internet and started looking at consumer reports.
Good. Okay, so you started looking at consumer reports. At that time, and bear in mind, all of us, let's think about this in terms of what we did individually. At that time, did you start to notice television advertisements for the type of cars that you were looking at?
Yes.
Okay. And did you possibly glance at a paper or anything like that?
Yes, I did.
Okay. Did you ask any friends or if they'd driven similar cars or what their experiences were?
I did that as well.
Good. Now, between that period of time and you actually purchasing a car, how long would you say it was?
4 weeks.
Okay. Now, that cycle is not untypical. And what's happening with Matthew, by the way, does everybody recognize that cycle or something along those lines? It may be not exactly what Matthew did, but similar, correct? You start to gather information.
Right.
Now, at the point that even before that 4 weeks, did you start to sort of gather any information before then, Matthew, or not?
I'm not sure, actually. I'm trying to think for you. I mean, yeah, I think I looked at financing.
Okay, good. So you see, even to that point, there were sort of little things seeping in all the time. And you started to go through a process of gathering information. And everybody will have their different means of gathering information. Now, at that period of time, now, is there everybody on this call, have we all done similar things in the past? Anybody done anything different? Now, at that period of time, and this can be a question not just for Matthew, but for any of us, before we determined that we were actually going to make a purchase, but whilst we were still gathering information, did any of us ever speak to a salesperson?
No.
That's a no. Anybody speak to salespeople before they're going to actually make the purchase?
I didn't.
Matthew didn't. So you just went in and you, the first salesperson, did you buy it with a salesperson involved, by the way?
I'm sorry?
Was a salesperson involved at all in the transaction?
Yes, yeah, I went to a dealership.
So you went to a dealership and you purchased a car from the first salesperson that you saw?
Yes.
Okay. Has anybody else ever talked to other salespeople before they make a purchase? Or does everybody do the same as Matthew?
This is Dennis. I haven't made a large purchase in a while, but usually I would have talked to somebody.
Right.
Not with a whole lot of interest.
Good. So you would have talked to a salesperson even before necessarily making a purchase. Anybody else had that experience?
Robert Jones out of Michigan.
Yeah.
When I was looking to purchase insurance, which was very recently a major purchase for me, I did talk to several salespeople, like three or four.
Thank
actually.
You. Exactly. Now, why did you do that?
I didn't want to get ripped off. I wanted to see what each one had to say.
Right. So, in other words, you used that, you gathered information from those salespeople.
Yes.
Why did you choose to gather information from salespeople?
I figured, I knew in my mind that they were the most knowledgeable.
Good.
So
in other words, they knew something that you didn't know.
Exactly.
And how much did you pay each of them individually for teaching you that?
Not 1 cent.
Right. And so typically, most of us will use salespeople as another form of information, particularly since that information usually comes at a bargain rate, nothing. And also particularly as most salespeople see it as their job to be educating us and informing us. So does that explain to all of us why we tend to find ourselves dealing in the lower or the middle parts of the pyramid? Right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's the key thing, folks, and these are key things coming up. When you went in and talked to that salesperson, Robert, or those salespeople, how did you appear?
Like I was, what do you mean, how did I appear?
Were you interested?
No, I was very interested.
Got it, right? Very interested. Everybody hear that?
Mm-hmm.
Were you ready to buy?
Yes, I was ready to buy.
At the time that you were very interested?
Yes.
So at the point that you were very, very interested, you made a purchase?
No.
Right. You made it afterwards, right?
Yes.
Now, I mean, I'm not trying to trap you here.
I understand.
That's actually what happened, right? You were very interested, which is why you went to ask questions, right?
Right.
So it's a common experience for many of us that when we're very, very interested in something, we will go and ask salespeople about it. Now, is it also a common experience that in those circumstances we'll tend to disguise our intention as to whether we're actually going to buy or not?
Right. They had no idea I was going to, you know.
Right. Now, why do we do that?
Because I didn't want to get ripped off.
Exactly. Now, that's the irony of it. The same reason that Robert went in to find information from salespeople, which is that he wanted to be informed and he knew that they knew stuff that he didn't, was exactly the same reason why he wasn't willing to reveal his intention, which is that he didn't want to get ripped off. Okay? Which is fair enough. And why don't we going to get ripped off? Because we know that's what salespeople do, don't we? That they try and get one over on us. They try and make us buy something that we don't necessarily think we should be buying. Okay? And that's the commonly conceived view of salespeople. Now, from the perspective of the salesperson, along comes Robert, and he's very, very, very interested, correct?
Yes.
Is he ready to buy?
At that time, honestly, I was not ready to buy.
Right. And this is the great... take a blank piece of paper, or you can write it on the back of one of the pieces of paper in your book and put down poison words. And here's poison word number one, and the word is interest. Okay? People that are interested rarely buy, because there's no commitment in interest. And there's only one person that's worse to deal with than the interested person if you're a salesperson, and that's the very interested person. So, very interested people don't buy, because they're just interested, and they're gathering information. Now, as salespeople, it's our belief that, for the most part, that interested people are the best people to talk to. In fact, they're the worst. And we're going to talk more about that later on in the course. But we don't want to spend our time with people that are interested. We want to spend our time with people that want what we have. Okay? They're the people that we're looking to talk to, primarily. People who want what we have. Okay? So, how do we identify those people? And here's the other thing. Now, at one point, did you actually buy that insurance in the end?
No.
You never bought it. Now, at the time that you determine if you're ever going to buy it, when you go and talk to whatever salesperson, how are you going to appear to them? Do you think? No. How are you going to determine that you're going to conduct yourself? Are you going to come in and say to the salesperson, for example, I want to buy this right away, please?
No, I just position yourself as you don't need this right now. You can wait.
So, and why is that, Robert?
Because you don't want to seem urgent or desperate.
That's right. So in other words, it's back to the same thing. You don't want to get ripped off, right?
Right.
Right. So here's the great irony. To the salesperson, the people who appear to be the most interested, right, are the least likely to buy. And the people who really are ready to buy appear to be not that interested. Isn't that bizarre? Now, why is that? The reason for that is because high probability prospects will not reveal themselves to somebody who takes a manipulative approach. And the reason they won't do it is because if they perceive that the person is going to try and rip them off or cheat them or get one over on them in some way or another, they will try and disguise their intentions. Because, and the irony of it is, it's because they really do want what it is that this person is supplying. They're just not sure whether they want to buy it from this particular person or not. Because they would prefer to buy it from somebody that they trust and respect. We'll talk more about that later on in the course. So, I'm not saying to you that you should deliberately go out and find people that tell you that they don't want what you have. That's not the message. The message is that high probability prospects will not reveal themselves to an inherently manipulative approach. And low probability prospects will appear to be very, very interested. And what that means is that they will waste a good deal of your time as you try and persuade them to do something that in most instances they won't do right then. Some of them will, but most of them won't. So before I proceed to the next point, is that surprising to anybody or did we all know that?
I think people know it, they just lie to themselves.
But what I'm asking you is, does it surprise us, or are we aware of the fact that interested people and people that want what we have are not the same people?
Yeah. Well, this is Bill. I recognize myself in the role of the person who's shielding his imminent purchase,
mm-hmm.
but I also recognize myself as a salesman who's running after that interested person,
good.
Thinking that that's my best prospect.
Yeah, good. Very good. And now, are we beginning to see how futile that type of endeavor is? Because when we look at it from both ends of the spectrum, then we realize that the waste and the inefficiency of that process. When you look at it just from the point of view of the customer, right, it's obvious. When you look at it just from the point of view of the salesperson who believes that persuasion is the key, then it's not obvious. But when you look at it from both sides like that, then it's obvious again. So the whole function of high probability high probability prospecting is to identify not people that are interested, but people that want what we have. So how do we do that? Well, it's fairly straightforward. What we do is we ask them. Okay? We ask them if they want what it is that we have. Okay? In a very, very straightforward manner. And we do it in a non-manipulative fashion. Okay? We do it in a fashion that comes forward as a very straightforward question without any manipulation whatsoever. And we have a very specific formulation for doing it. Now, the next question is if that's how we're going to ask them what we ask, who do we ask? Who do we ask? Now, the question as to who we ask is the people who are most likely to be wanting to want our product or service at any particular period of time. So, for example, let's take some obvious examples. It is unlikely that a 15-year-old person is going to want life insurance. They're normally not thinking about things like life insurance. It is also unlikely that a 70-year-old person is going to want a ticket at a Britney Spears concert. Thinking about that, maybe it's not that unlikely. I don't know. But you can see that, you know, just from those examples, that there are obviously certain broad categories where it's more likely that people are willing to purchase from us than others. Let's take more specifics. Let's take our life insurance again. It's probably more likely that somebody who is married is going to purchase life insurance than somebody who is unmarried, or at least not with a stable partner. It's probably even more likely that somebody with children is going to purchase life insurance than somebody who is married and has no children. It may be more likely that somebody whose children are between the ages, let's say, of 5 and 18 is more likely to purchase life insurance than somebody whose children are all beyond the ages of 30. I'm not saying it's impossible for the others, I'm just saying the nature of the likelihood. Let's look at individual life insurance policies. It's probably more likely that somebody who has very, very little interest in the stock market but who wants life insurance is going to purchase term or possibly whole life insurance than variable universal life. Somebody who tends to be financially more sophisticated would have a greater likelihood of purchasing variable universal life because it's a more sophisticated product than someone that's not. And I'm sure that we could find other demographics, many others, related to income, family circumstances, locality, and all sorts of other factors that would indicate somebody's likelihood to purchase a particular product or service. Now, for the product or service that we're individually selling, there are definitely people who are more likely to buy and people who are less likely to buy. And some of it is fairly obvious. Another quick example, some years ago I was a marketing director of a company that specialized in services involved in asset investigation. Our primary marketplaces were attorneys, followed by private investigators, followed by some real estate companies. Now let's take the biggest market, attorneys. Although that was our primary market, it was only a specific groups of attorneys, ones who litigated and brought cases to judgment, who really wanted what we had. And within that group, there was a finer demographic as well. That was the target of our marketing. The target of our prospecting was even finer than that. It was mainly attorneys involved in the field of collections law. They constituted the bulk of our clients. So we had a fairly fine demographic. So when you identify your demographic, what you do is you contact people on a regular basis and ask them if they want what you have to sell. And most of them won't, and a small percentage will. And that is true for every marketplace. And how do we know it's true, folks?
data.
Yeah. What's the primary reason that we know it's true? I mentioned it already.
Most people are in the stratification are they don't want what you have.
True, but what's the primary reason that we know that some of them do? How do we know the primary reason that there is such a thing as high probability prospects? It's because people buy stuff, isn't it? Simple. Very simple answer. It's because people buy stuff. Maybe not from us. Some of them buy from us. Some of them buy from others. So here's what our objective is in high probability prospecting. Our objective is to have a way of efficiently identifying very, very quickly who in our target market are high probability prospects right now and eliminate everybody else, at least for now. Now, let me come back to Matthew and him buying the car. 6 weeks before you bought a car, Matthew, did you have any interest in buying a car?
No.
Okay. Then there was a four-week period of time in which you became very interested. Correct?
Correct.
And then you bought the car?
Yes.
After you bought the car, were you interested in buying a car?
No.
Right. Now most of us are... some of us have already had lunch, but for those of us that haven't, just before lunchtime, we all become high probability prospects for lunch, if we eat lunch. Once we've eaten lunch, we're no longer high probability prospects, until the next day at about the same time. Correct?
Correct.
So, high probability prospects is not something that happens once in somebody's life, because Matthew's probably going to buy another car, and so the rest of us at some point, but there's a cycle. But most of the time, Matthew is not a high probability prospect and none of the rest of us are for cars. For a certain key period of time, he is a high probability prospect, and then once he purchases it, he's no longer a high probability prospect until he becomes one again. Now, is it possible for me to predict with any certainty when Matthew will become a high probability prospect for a car?
No.
Not really. I mean, I might say, for example, well, I know that Matthew... is how old are you, Matthew?
34.
Okay, I might say that people between 30 and 40 tend to buy their cars every 5 years. They tend to buy cars between a certain period, between a certain value, and I can get certain demographic features which would put Matthew in some sort of a group. And as far as group behavior is concerned, I could predict that with some accuracy. I might be able to predict with considerable accuracy the mean average time between Matthew's car purchases. And that applies to the group, because probability is something that applies to group activities, but not to individuals. But I have no idea individually when Matthew is going to purchase a car. I just know that as a part of a group, he's going to do it on a certain cycle. Do we agree?
Mm-hmm.
So what's the answer to that? If I don't know exactly when Matthew's going to purchase a car, but I know that sometime he's going to purchase a car, what do I have to do?
Ask him.
Yeah, ask him, and how often do I ask him?
Until he's ready to purchase another car.
Yeah, I ask him regularly, right? And I have to ask him regularly in such a way that he doesn't see me as being an irritating pain in the butt. So if I call up Matthew and I say to him, hey Matthew, want to buy a car? Want to buy a car? And he says no. And I call him up in 3 weeks' time and I say, hey Matthew, I've got a really great car. Do you want to buy a car? It's really nice. It's red and it 0 to 60 in 5 seconds. I get it to his special friends. Want to buy a car? How many of those calls do you think Matthew's going to take from me? Yeah, if I'm lucky, right? But isn't that more or less the type of conversation that we're trying to have as salespeople?
Yes.
So, here's what it is. We're going to show you a methodology where you can contact people on a regular basis, which is not going to be stressful to you, and is not going to be stressful to them. That you're going to be able to identify very, very clearly what it is that you're selling, and they're going to know what it is. Is what you're selling, and you're going to have give them an opportunity to tell you whether they want to at least potentially buy what you're selling or not. And when they say to you that they don't want to buy what you're selling, guess what you're going to do? Everybody except Chris Wheatland, you should know the answer to this. When somebody says to you, I don't know, I don't want that. What are you going to do?
Hang up.
That's right. You're going to go away. Okay? You're going to take their answer at face value. But you're going to call them again. As long as they remain within your demographic.
Neil?
Yeah.
This is Robert Jones. Can I call back on this line?
Sure.
Sorry to interrupt.
That's okay. By the way, folks, this session is a little bit longer than most. Most are about somewhere between 60 to 90 minutes. Now, we've determined that some portion of your marketplace are high probability prospects, okay? And that we've determined that if we want to find out who that is, we need to call them on a regular basis, because we don't exactly know who they are. And this brings us to page 4 of the selling section, of the prospecting section of your workbook. If our objective is to call people who we perceive as people who need what we have and try to persuade them to meet with us, right, then what do you think our experiences are going to be like?
Suck.
Yeah. Why is it going to suck?
Because it's not a pleasant experience for either party.
Exactly. Because people don't want to be persuaded. We may want to buy, but we don't want to be persuaded to buy. Correct? So if that's our objective on each call, which is, in other words, to call people who we think need what we have and to try and persuade them that, in fact, they really not only should need what we have but want what we have, and to try and manipulate them by persuasion into getting an appointment, most times we're going to fail, and sometimes we're going to succeed, and in both instances, we're probably going to feel pretty miserable about the process, and we're going to stop doing it or not do it at all. Now, here's another way of doing what appears to be a similar activity, but emotionally and in terms of effectiveness is completely different. You call people up and you make them a prospecting offer. And if they want what you have, you ask them to clarify, which we're going to come on to, and if not, you disqualify them. Gently, but definitely. Okay? Now that process is a process that we call disqualification. It's similar to this process. If I was to turn down a pack of cards face down on a table, and I was to ask any of you to identify the aces as quickly as possible, what would you do? How would you proceed?
Cards.
Sorry?
I would start flipping the cards one by one.
Right. Exactly. Now, how long would you persuade, how long would you take persuading a six of clubs it was an ace of spades? None. You just move on. Now, if that six of clubs was not an ace of spades, would you get angry at it? Would you get depressed?
Angry at myself.
Well, what would you get angry at yourself at? Trying to persuade it?
Yes.
Right, and not moving on. Would you spend a lot of resources persuading it should be an ace of spades, and it really was very nice for it to be an ace of spades? And there are a lot of advantages to it being an ace of spades. You just move right on, correct? And that's exactly what we do with high probability prospecting. We give our prospecting offer, we determine if somebody is a high probability prospect or not, and if they're not, we move on. And how do we know that somebody is a high probability prospect? Because they, A, say that, yes, that is what they want, and B, they behave in a certain way. Generally, they show high levels of enthusiasm. They're very enthusiastic when we reach them. But here's the irony, which I'll repeat once again. They want high probability prospects will not stand up, will not reveal themselves to salespeople that they believe are acting or in a persuasive or manipulative manner. So, there are many, many, many more high probability prospects than we could possibly identify out there in the marketplace right now. So there is an abundance of them. And again, we know there is an abundance because there's a lot of stuff being sold. So we have to determine which part of the marketplace we want to talk to, and we have to move through them very, very efficiently and rapidly. And we also have to approach them in such a way that they will reveal themselves. So to the person who's trained in high probability prospecting, high probability prospects are in abundance in most marketplaces for many products and services. For people who are not trained in the process, there will appear to be almost none of them there at all. Do you understand why, folks? Is it clear why?
Could you repeat that one more time, please?
Yeah. For people that are trained in high probability prospecting and are approaching their prospects in a non-manipulative manner, there will be many high probability prospects. For people that are approaching them in a manipulative manner, there won't be. There will appear to be almost none or none. Why is that?
Because of the reason you just said,
they won't identify themselves.
Yeah, they won't identify themselves.
Right. So this is what comes back to the paradigm. So your paradigm is an entirely different one in high probability prospecting and selling. Your paradigm is one of disqualification. You're going to disqualify everybody that is not a high probability prospect and only deal with those people that are high probability prospects. And your view of the world is going to be entirely different, because instead of you having to, in this current age of information, do what was done maybe 50 or 80 or even 30 years ago, which is to try and persuade everybody that had a need that they should want what you have to sell, what you have to do is allow all that information overload to act for you and identify those people that are ready to do business now, assuming that you can meet their conditions of satisfaction. That's your role as a salesperson in this day and age, is to identify those people that are ready to do business now, assuming you can meet their conditions of satisfaction. Now, put in those ways, that sounds like a very easy thing to do. And if it's done correctly, it's not too difficult. But it demands a certain approach. And the key approach it demands is one of non-manipulation, of being absolutely straightforward in the way that you conduct yourself. Because otherwise, you're just going to be seen as another manipulative sales guy and you're going to have the same results. So, what we're going to do is we're going to show you in subsequent sessions exactly how to do that in prospecting and exactly how to do that in sales. Does anybody have any questions about anything that we've covered at all?